Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and joins us for the weekly update here at JM in the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to the program.
Good morning to you. Is Professor Tursky's article about you?
No.
Oh, okay.
But that was very nice of you.
You're welcome. That's what you said.
It wasn't
today, right?
It wasn't what man is greater than the angels.
Oh,
it's why man is greater than the angels. A philosophical.
Never mind.
A philosophical discussion. So, a very interesting week at the United Nations. Let's start with this. According to Mahmoud Abbas, and you do always tell us to pay careful attention to what the quote unquote other side is saying, right? Always pay careful attention to what they're saying, including Ahmadinejad and obviously including Abbas this week at the UN. PA President Mahmoud Abbas, and I'm reading from the Jerusalem Post, made it clear Friday that despite heavy international pressure, he is determined to present a request to the UN to be accepted as a full member after his speech at the General Assembly. During a meeting with 200 Palestinian-American leaders, Abbas said, "I have to tell you something important." This is a quote. "I am under heavy pressure not to go to the UN, but also I want to say that I will go to the Security Council, and I have no intention to withdraw the request, no matter what pressure there is." So first of all, he's exposed the first part of his hand, Malcolm. It's going to be Security Council and not General Assembly, right?
Right.
And secondly, he, and I think you've mentioned this to us before, you can't get anywhere, whether the U.S. uses its veto power or not, you can't get anywhere without 9 out of 15 votes, correct?
Right.
Now what happens? Is he going to get 8, as was predicted earlier in the week, or can he actually get to 9 if he does this today?
Okay, so when people ask why I said all along that he won't go to the, that he would go to the Security Council, despite knowing that ultimately he would face a U.S. veto and U.S. anger, as President Obama expressed to him during the week and leaked to the press,
right,
and made clear that why they thought this was counterproductive, and so did many Europeans and others, who, while they would support some limited improvement in the status of the Palestinians or some recognition, do not agree with the measure, and it's reflected in the fact that most of them would vote against or abstain on a UN Security Council vote. It's not just that you need 9 affirmative votes. So if an abstention is like a no vote.
You need 9 yeses.
You need 9 yeses. And the reason why I kept saying it is because I listened to what he said. And if you listened to what he said, you knew he was going to go to the Security Council. Because he has positioned himself, he painted himself into a corner with this over the last few weeks. And in essence, it had to be a non-event. Why? Because when he makes the presentation of the letter, he's not going to pursue it right away. They could short-circuit the process, or they can have an elongated process, which means the way it works is the Secretary General takes the letter, he goes and makes the request to the President of the Security Council, who's from Lebanon,
right,
and they then appoint a committee that has to review it, so they'll be able to take their time. It can take months, can take as long as they want it to be, or they could have short-circuited, come up with an immediate recommendation, bring it to a vote, and without 9 votes. And it's still unclear because there's certain countries, Gabon, others, who have waffled on the position, and some who have said they haven't made it clear, but they told in private conversations that they're voting one way or the other.
What continent is Gabon on?
Africa.
Now, it just as an aside for a second, the likelihood is that in the General Assembly, obviously, he would have had the votes for this lower status, but he's completely skipping over that. In other words, when you say
it doesn't mean he can go back and he can do that anytime.
So what's the timetable? Is there going to be any type of vote this week or during this session, I should say?
I do not believe there'll be a vote right now. The session goes till the end of December, so it could be within this session, and
gotcha.
He can always go to the General Assembly. But the critical question was, does he go to the Security Council, because they're the only ones who can authorize a membership.
So the hard work is just starting now.
Pardon me?
The hard work behind the scenes is just starting now. Meaning for those against what he's doing.
Well, the United States, Israel, others, we have been meeting day and night with foreign ministers and prime ministers and many more than I ever want to see or have to go through the routine, but it's very important. It's something we started almost 7 months ago. We've had hundreds and hundreds of meetings here and abroad, and that's just on the part of the representatives of the Jewish community here. And then, of course, the Israelis have been doing it. The Americans have been issuing demarches. Members of Congress have been calling foreign leaders with whom they deal and whom they know to press them. Unfortunately, Mr. Sarkozy of France has played a very negative role. The Russians have been very bad on this. The British actually came out better, Cameron's statements, et cetera, and there's a lot of anger now between them. And the Europeans, in all of our meetings this week, it was clear that their biggest emphasis is not on the substance, but on maintaining the unity of Europe, which is being torn apart anyway over right. financial and other issues. Right. They're driven by saying, and every one of them keeps talking, and I said, but isn't the substance more important than the question of unity, of getting something that is constructive? And I always press them on the fact that what point is Abbas not better than the alternatives? Where's the message? If there's never a consequence to the things he does, then you're just encouraging such irresponsibility. And that's the problem in the past. There was never a consequence. So I think the two turning points were, one, when Congress voted overwhelmingly, unanimously in the Senate, 406-7 in the House, that they would cut funding at a time when the PA can't pay the salaries. And second, when the administration said we're going to veto no matter what, if you bring it to the Security Council.
So, by the way, as another aside, because you brought it up, so I'll skip to it for a second. When it comes to Europe and Russia, these rumors that the quartet could split up or the quartet could release separate statements, U.S. and U.K., as opposed to the statements of Europe and Russia, is there a reality to this? Is that what's really going to happen?
There is a reality to it. It's not clear that that's what's going to happen yet because they're still working. The quartet is still meeting and working, the quartet being the EU, the United States, Russia, and Europe. They are still working on it. The Russians, as I said, have been playing a negative role. They've been trying to pressure countries to vote for the unilateral declaration.
Wait, it can't be EU and Europe. It's Russia, U.S.
UN and EU.
Oh, UN and Europe, okay.
And so the answer is yes, it could end up being independent declarations. But even within the EU, it could end up being independent declarations.
And that would mean that they never as a group again are going to be involved in this peace process?
No, it means that it's happened before many times. The quartet doesn't.
Oh, really? I don't remember
separate
statements.
The Russians are the blocking party right now on the resolution. They want tougher stuff, and they want to be more supportive of the unilateral declaration.
As the EU would, right?
The message and Kosovo that this is the way you go about, not negotiations, but go to the UN and...
But wouldn't you toss the EU on the Russian side also?
Pardon me?
Wouldn't you toss the EU on the Russian side also?
No. The EU is split three ways. There are those who are with Israel. That's Germany, Netherlands, Holland, Czech Republic, Italy. There are those who are against, especially Scandinavian countries, others. And then you have those who are in the middle, and that's varying degrees of middle, leaning one side or the other.
Okay, so we'll have splits within the split. That's the direction we're going in.
But the United States has been consistent and has been pressuring in these negotiations very hard.
Now, Ahmadinejad speaks yesterday, and a number of countries, their representatives walk out, right?
Most democracies.
Oh, the majority?
Walked out of a ready, empty room, and most of them were represented at low levels. Very few had, had state or significant leaders.
Now, today when Abbas speaks, does anybody walk out or not?
Oh, everybody wants to hear what he has to say. If he starts engaging in the kind of anti-Semitic, ludicrous kind of charges that the Ahmadinejad people will walk out.
All right, so they reserve that right, so to speak. It could happen. And the order of speakers, is it going to be Netanyahu before Abbas or Abbas before Netanyahu?
This year, the order changes every year, but except for the president, always speaks second. I think it's after Brazil was the first to speak this year. The order is that Abbas is the 14th speaker and Netanyahu is the 17th speaker.
I wonder who's between them.
I don't know, but it's not a great position to be in because everybody's going to be waiting for the rebuttal.
All the attention.
And they're supposed to speak for 15 minutes. Unfortunately, that's not the case. So while Netanyahu's schedule at 12:30, it's altogether unclear that will in fact be the case because of the... tendency for some to be verbose.
All right, so Netanyahu speaks. Is it going to be similar to some of the public declarations he's made, for instance, the one in Washington earlier this year? Will it not be that strong? What are you expecting from his speech?
Well, I think he will lay out the security needs. I think he will talk about the impact of the changing Middle East. I think he will reach out to Abbas and to the Palestinians. Again, it depends on what Abbas says, because he'll have the opportunity then to answer in kind to what he says. But I think his message is really more for the world to at a time when there are all the charges that Israel's isolated. Believe me, he's having as many bilateral meetings as humanly possible. Everybody still wants to see him, and they meet with him. He had a good meeting with the president. He has had other good meetings and some not-so-good meetings. But I'm told that the speech will be a very strong one. He will discuss also Israel's security needs in light of the changes in the region.
What do you think of the Obama speech in regard to the Israel stuff, of course?
Look, I think any objective analysis will say that there were things in there that we've never heard before in a UN speech, that the things that we had asked why they weren't included in earlier speeches were all there. He did embrace Israel. He did. I mean, the criticism was clearly directed at the Palestinians, even though not strong criticism, but the references to the Jews in their historic homeland, talk about what Israel's needs and Israel's children getting up living in hate, talking about the incitement, talking about the threats against Israel, and telling people that that's, that it's a lie and it's distortion. Those were all very important statements.
It looks like it got Ed Koch to flip his opinion about him.
Well, Ed Koch, yes, because it was a good...
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know who he's supporting in what race that's coming up.
Well, it depends what day. But he's entitled to his views, and he says what... comes to mind. He's very blunt. But I don't think that it's a question of Ed Koch. I think people should read the speech and make their own judgments. It doesn't mean that there's a fundamental change or shift. It means that the president sought to embrace it. You know, there are people who cynically call it the Queen's Ninth speech, meaning the Ninth District at Queens.
Right.
For the world, for the people sitting in that room, the world leaders there, and everybody comes to the president's speech, it was important that he put some of these markers down.
What do you think of yeshivas who shared the speech with their students, who used it as class material to show their students what was going on at the UN? Is that a good idea or not?
It's an excellent idea. I only wish they would do more of it, not just the speech, but talk about the realities, because unfortunately, and I just met with a group yesterday discussing this, yeshiva kids in some of the best schools, there are exceptions, know nothing about what's going on. They know nothing. They're not able to answer, and they fall victim to the same doubts and questions. So any yeshiva that is making the effort to have people understand the issues, but they have to talk to them not just about the speech, but what is happening in the UN, what is the motivation behind it, why this is dangerous for Israel, and also why I think it's going to fizzle. There ain't going to be any tsunami.
That's for sure. You know where I got my political science education?
I'm afraid to hear.
My Shabbos table at home when growing up.
Well, that's because, yes, and that's very important.
Oh, 100%. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmn.org. More in a minute about the UN and some of the chutzpah of the week, which I'll do with Malcolm in a second. I just have to mention, especially since we spoke about education, Malcolm, I remind you that Toldot Yisrael has this amazing channel on YouTube. You know about it, with actual people who are at these historic events in the 20th century in the building of the State of Israel. One of them is about the shofar blowers at the Kotel before the state during the British Mandate. This is the time of year to show that to students out there, right?
Absolutely. It's available online. It's in a remarkable story, and it's something people don't know. They don't know the history of...
And the sacrifice.
And even those who are knowledgeable don't know the history of the shofar blowers. And how they could be subject to arrest if you blew the shofar under the British Mandate, not under Arab control, but the British Mandate. It was illegal to blow the shofar at the Kotel,
which they wanted to do at the end of Yom Kippur.
And they would sneak it in, and they would it would come under their coats, and they would do it. And then what they would do is have people placed at different locations.
Right.
So they would blow in one place, and the police would run, and somebody would blow at the other end.
If you have speedy kids in your family, they'll appreciate it because that they can relate to the fact that they needed young, really fast kids to pull this thing off. Toldot Yisrael channel, folks. It's on YouTube. Check it out, especially if you're an educator. Chutzpah of the week. I found a couple of things. First of all, Erdogan is out of control. I mean, he's completely out of control. If you want to bring tomatoes into Israel, you got to go through, a whole international process. I mean, it is such an exaggeration and it is such a demonization of Israel. I think we've gotten to a point where his public statements about Israel really leave him no room to turn back on this issue.
And he's becoming more extreme, and he is sounding more and more like Ahmadinejad.
Right, exactly.
And the importance goes beyond just the rhetoric of what he's saying. One of the things that people pointed out, and analysts are going to look at, is that he has awakened the Russians. The Russians have now said that they are going to send ships to protect Cyprus and its right to develop the Mediterranean gas. And it has ties to Noble Energy, which is doing it. But you know that one of the people they found out that was on the Mavi Marmara, the boat that was in the original flotilla that Israel seized and where we had the confrontation, one of the people on there was a guy named Erdin Tekir, who participated in the 1996 terrorist attack on a Russian ferry in the Black Sea, which was meant to get the release of Chechen terrorists from a Russian prison. And some of the IHH founders and members were part of a Mujahideen brigade that fought the Russian Serbian allies in the Bosnian War. So all of a sudden now the Russians are looking at this and saying, we're seeing the Ottoman Empire. And you know that sends chills up the Russians' backs. They also are raising the stakes all the time, saying that they're going to send warships into the area where they're doing the exploratory drilling. Noble actually started exploratory drilling right now. And this also threatens, of course, Israel's, and Israel and Cyprus have reached an accord and are doing things together. He has really gone off the deep end. But as I said before, people have to understand this is a guy who is a fundamentalist. He is an Islamist who subscribes to his foreign ministry's neo-Ottoman aspirations. He's a dangerous character. His involvement now in other countries, you know, that they just opened up a special air flight from Turkey to Venezuela, so paralleling what the Iranians did, and trying to, even in some places, I believe, supplant Iran, with whom they're having a split because of Iran is angry at them over their criticisms and attacks on Syria, which came belatedly. So it is a serious situation because Turkey is a powerful country, an important country. It was one of the cornerstones of Israel's Mediterranean security situation. Thank God the relationship with Greece has improved so much, and Israel has alternatives. Right. But this is not something simply to be dismissed. That Turkey, unlike the reports you read, is having economic problems. A lot of the statistics they put out are doctored statistics about their economic growth. So it is not at all the way that they are the way they're being portrayed. He is a long-term Islamist who followed Erbakan, an extremist. That's his mentor.
So, I mean, if when I was growing up, the impression was that Russia was controlling the Middle East, or at least, you know, felt they were. And if that switched, or if that became shared with, you know, Iraq and Iran eventually, as, you know, we progressed till today. So now basically Turkey wants a piece of the action. They're more concerned about their controlling interest in the region than the relationship with Israel.
Oh, far more. And they are demanding and keep escalating the demands for an apology. And I will tell you that some of the European leaders we met, people said, oh, why don't they just apologize. And when I tell him the facts and how he just keeps, he's not just asking for an apology. He wants Israel to announce that they're going to end the embargo, which was proved legal, and they say they're going to the international court to challenge it. So the real goal here is not because they were insulted over this or that. They walked out on Shimon Peres at an international conference
again.
Not the first one, again, this past week. Mm. And you know, they're doing everything possible to undermine and defeat extremists. The Muslim Brotherhood have long associations inside with Turkey, meeting in Turkey. So this is a development that's escalating, and we don't know yet what the outcome will be.
By the way, there's when Abbas speaks today, speaking of flotillas, there's going to be a flotilla on the East River. You heard about that?
No, they can't go near the UN, though, because it's blocked. So if there is a flotilla, it's going to be, it can go on the East River, but not near the UN.
Mm, it'll be near Rikers Island.
It's sort of like First Avenue, Second Avenue, Third Avenue, none of which you can get to these days.
Hmm. All right. I'm trying to remember exactly what the news report said. The point, of course, is that there's going to be a protest, or I should say a demonstration of support for Mahmoud Abbas. The second chutzpah of the week. When the president declared that there's no shortcut to peace, so I don't know if you heard this, Hanan Ashrawi said no shortcut to peace. We've been at this for 20 years. I had to laugh. at the lab with a thousands of years history at a conflict that goes back centuries, she's freaking out that we're at this for 20 years and that's not a shortcut.
Well, I have to say that the Palestinian spokesmen were well prepared. They've been out there, and their agents like Brzezinski and many others, with no bouchon, no restrictions, they lie, they distort, they misrepresent. And unfortunately, you hear these lines now being echoed back by representatives even of countries that are considered friendly to Israel, will raise these questions. And when we challenge them and we tell them the facts, you know, they look at you bewilderedly and saying, well, you know, we didn't know that. And this is after months of educating and months of reaching out to them. And yet you see how strong the propaganda is. I think that for many, the events of this week, and we should mention Durban 3 also in a minute, but right. This whole exercise now is generally leading to a state of such heightened frustration and anger at Abbas, by the way, and a feeling that he's misled his people, that he's misled the UN, that he keeps dangling everybody, and then in the end comes back and goes on his own merry way with whatever he wants to do.
Yep, that's for sure. Third chutzpah of the week from my end was the article that Bill Clinton participated in the Foreign Policy News website, where he laments the Rabin assassination and the Sharon stroke, because if not for Netanyahu, there would be tremendous advances in the peace process. That sounded like chutzpah to me.
Well, I think it's way beyond chutzpah. It's almost inconceivable for Bill Clinton, who has not said these kind of things in the past, not at least to that degree. We know he didn't have a love affair with Netanyahu going back years, but what he did is he gave a briefing on the sidelines of the Clinton Initiative, the Clinton Global Initiative, which is meeting in New York. It ended yesterday, and he, in his comments, literally laid the onus solely on Netanyahu, when he has, in fact, in the past, acknowledged that it was Arafat who sabotaged the peace talks, that Abbas was an obstacle to the peace. His wife has been saying it in her public declarations, calling on Abbas not to go to the Security Council. And yet he, in this almost rant, just simply went after Netanyahu. I would say it's more than a chutzpah. And, I don't know if he wants to join the Jimmy Carter Club of former presidents.
He's heading that way.
But he's certainly moving there.
He's certainly heading that way. Riots in Israel, there's a lot of concern. I know that, obviously everybody's concerned, those who live there, those who have relatives there, and those who look at Israel very carefully. I know that today is an especially concerning day security-wise. It's Friday, as we know, and that's often a more active day, so to speak, when it comes to riots and demonstrations by the enemy. On top of that, we have the proposals I think Abbas this week, and I wish I had the quotes in front of me, I think Abbas this week essentially was calling for riots, demonstrations, and violence.
No, he did not call for violence.
Sounded like he hinted to it.
He did. I can't say that I've read every single speech and every utterance. It's almost impossible. He talks all the time. But I think, first, if you look at what he did, he has encouraged, and they have called for big demonstrations. He gave everybody a day off, from the schools and government. So about 80,000 people got the day off. And yet, the whole demonstration in Ramallah was less than 10,000 people, when they were expecting tens of thousands of people. The same thing is true of the other demonstrations that they have tried to organize, including those here, have not come anywhere near what they were organizing, and they've spent a lot of money on PR and campaigning here. Israel has worked very hard to prepare non-lethal means of crowd control. The settlements and communities in Yehuda and Shomron have all prepared their security. There are 22,000 police officers who have been deployed, in addition to extra army people. All the leaves have been canceled, and everybody is prepared. But I don't think that the mood, from what I see, and because people, even in the Palestinians, have expressed frustration over this whole exercise, because they don't see that it's going to change anything, and in fact might cost them heavily in terms of U.S. aid, that Israel developed a thing called the SCREAM, which they used for the first time yesterday. Have you heard about it?
No, what is it?
It's a secret weapon, which maybe we'll come and test here, but it emits such a high-level noise that people can't stand it. It knocks people down, but it's a means of crowd control, riot control, that's completely non-lethal, and it's it seems to be very effective.
Very interesting. Two more things before we turn to Malcolm for the New Year message for 5772. A Durbin 3 update, Mr. Honlein.
Right. So I think, again, based on all that we said over the months about this, this was a Durbin event. It was a non-event. It was contained in one day. There's been almost no coverage of it, of the event itself. It was seen as a non-event. Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General, did what he promised us he would do. He walked out right after his speech. Almost no head of state went to it. The room was mostly empty for the bulk of the conference. The Iranian foreign minister and Chavez, other guys, you know, get up there and ranted and raved, but they were doing it to themselves, essentially. And there's no consequence from this day. It was not a Durban conference. It was a commemoration of the first one. And the fact that 16 of the major countries announced before, and many more just said that they weren't going to go. They didn't make formal announcements in advance, but told us that they weren't going. And some sent third-level representatives to sit there, and some had to be there because they were speaking. But as we said, we did not hold demonstrations against Durban 3, and I know people raised the question. And as I explained here many times, the thinking that we consultation with Israeli officials, American officials, others who are experts on the UN, did not want to build it up. With all the effort that was made to diminish it and relegate it to insignificance, as in fact is the case, there wasn't one article before it about it. There's hardly any coverage, and I haven't seen any, but I'm sure there must be somebody who wrote about it. So we made it a non-event, and it did not focus on Israel. It didn't attack Israel, right, except for some of the speakers. So sometimes people have to look beyond the moment and the automatic calls and everybody saying it's one thing to demonstrate for Israel. It's another thing to focus on an event, and our goal is to end this Durban process, to put finally a stop to it after they've had two conferences, which the second one we actually, I think, were very effective in countering. So it was a non-event.
Secondly, the pressure on Israel this week to join the anti-nuclear treaty, a Mideast treaty, was this any more pressure-filled on Israel than other calls that we've had on this in the past?
I would say yes, that I take it very seriously. I don't know how seriously maybe the Israelis, but I believe that they do. This is the call itself is something that the Arab countries have pushed very hard for a long time because they want to strip Israel of its supposed, if it has, nuclear weapons. And obviously it's something Israel can't subscribe to. And Israel's not a signatory to the IAEA. It's not a member of the non-proliferation. So it's not bound by it, but yes, I do take it seriously, and it is something that you could see Erdogan and others raising the profile of this issue more and more.
By the way, and this actually might lead right into your New Year message, because this is the final conversation we'll have on the air for 5771. By the way, folks, we return 2 weeks from today, Erev Yom Kippur, 2 weeks from today, and then, of course, a weekly update will pick up after the holidays. So many people are focused on Ahmadinejad, and I know that there wasn't the panic that there was in the first time he spoke at the UN, because people are unfortunately used to what he has to say at this point. But I think we really have, as a people and as a community, have to stop focusing. Obviously, we have to pay attention to what he says, as you always remind us. But in terms of what has to be done, we have to stop worrying about Ahmadinejad and really start worrying more about what we as a community and as individuals are doing when it comes to these efforts.
That's right. We have such an array of concerns right now with the changes in the Middle East that we're seeing an Arab Spring described by some. I think it's closer to an Arab winter. I don't think this is a great move towards democracy. It changes all of the calculations. When you have Egypt shifting in the way it has, when you have Turkey shifting in the way it is and will continue to be. So it's not just Ahmadinejad, it's also Erdogan, and God willing, one day both of them will realize that the other is the competition and go to war with each other, and may they both win and eliminate a lot of problems for a lot of people. I don't want the Turkish people to suffer, and I don't want the Iranians to suffer, but the two of them we could do without. And Mr. Chavez, who wrote this blasphemous letter to the Secretary General attacking Israel, and, you know, Ahmadinejad, of course, in his U.N. speech. But if you notice, he's not invited anywhere. And even that Columbia story turned out not to be true. One student wrote him, there never was a meeting. It was never involved the Columbia University administration. And so those who attacked him ought to write him a letter saying that, you know, that they misunderstood, because they really had nothing to do with it. And you notice he's not getting vetted, and you don't see pictures like you used to, because there's a growing recognition of the need to isolate him and to put all these issues and to understand what the nature of these challenges, because they're not going away. This is not temporary issues. And when we say that we want to husband our resources to be able to target it in an appropriate way, if people knew how many things we've done over the last 6 months and over the last couple weeks, it's not stuff where you go public with it, but believe me, it is effective. And we're learning how to use 21st century technologies, how to get out of the mode that if you think of this year with everything that occurred from earthquakes and fires and stuff, when they say mi ba'esh and mi ba'mayim, when we think about the decisions that we consider on Rosh Hashanah, when we think about, none of us has the control ultimately, but all of us have the ability to affect, and that affects our own future and our tefillot and what we do in terms of tshuva and the penitence that we're all required to do. But it also have to think about it in communal sense, and it's very easy for people. I'm sure they call you and they criticize why we didn't do this and why we didn't do that. It's not easy decisions that we make. Believe me, the easiest thing is call a demonstration, have a few people show up, and most of those who call and complain don't show up when we do the demonstration, as we saw with the Ahmadinejad year after year rallies, where many more Christians than Jews and many more people called than came. And I know it's very difficult during this week with the logistical problems and the demonstrations were held, you know, whatever they were. I saw the Palestinian demonstrations didn't get coverage. They couldn't build it up. The Iranians had huge crowds out, which is exactly what we want. We want to see Iranians and non-Jews, that it doesn't always become, you know, the Jewish community is the one demonstrating. Ahmadinejad is everybody's problem. And I would hope that people will take a step back and just listen to what we have to say and think about it before you react to it. And understand that we all have the same goal, and that when a decision is made, it's not just somebody pulls something out of the hat and all of a sudden decides things. There are things where there are security considerations. There are so many factors that go into a decision, as we saw during this week,
right,
that people have to understand.
Very good message. Someone told me you're Sunday in New Jersey?
I am Sunday morning in New Jersey. I am at the Y, and I hope people will come.
What is that, in Clifton?
It's right down the block from Matus's house. So go to Matus's house and walk 1 minute away.
So it must be Union, I guess.
Yeah.
Hang on a second. Malcolm, this Sunday, thank you to the person who just sent this. Malcolm, this Sunday at 11 a.m., guest speaker. It'll be free to Y members, $5 for everybody else. It's an open house program, 501 Green Lane in Union. Call 908-289-8112.
Next Friday at Clifton Lakes, if the people who can, I guess they can still get a reservation if they want to come for Rosh Hashanah. And you can look for the ads in the paper. I don't know if they're still there, but
Clifton Lakes?
In New Jersey. What is it called? I don't know.
Anybody out there know where Malcolm is for Rosh Hashanah? Because I guarantee you neither of us know.
Sunday afternoon I'm speaking at a conference in Manhattan, so everybody who didn't make it to New Jersey can make it there.
What day is that?
Sunday afternoon. The conference on delegitimization.
We have to do a much better job in terms of the info about your speaking engagements.
Well, as somebody who didn't go to bed at all last night, worked straight through the night, I'm doing pretty well. Knowing my name.
Get somebody in your office to take care of it. I take this opportunity to wish you a happy, healthy, sweet new year. Let it be a year of peace for all of Israel. And remember, Mr. Holmline, the future of the Jewish people is in the state of Israel.
Absolutely right.
Thank you so much. Shana Tova Umetuka. Malcolm Holmline is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Weekly update on Fridays, which means 2 weeks from today, Erev Yom Kippur, Malcolm will join us. And then right after Shabbos Bereishis, Erev Shabbos Noach, I guess it would be, I don't have the secular date in front of me, but obviously once the holidays end, we'll pick up with the weekly update Friday mornings at 7:40 Eastern time here at JM in the AM.